Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists and thinkers is Mike Petters, the president and CEO of Huntington Ingalls Industries, the nation's leading shipbuilder and the sole maker of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and big-deck amphibious assault ships. He joins us on the 10th anniversary of the company's spinoff from Northrop Grumman to again become an independent firm. He's a 1982 graduate in physics from the United States Naval Academy and served aboard USS George Bancroft, one of the illustrious 41 for Freedom boats, before joining Newport News Shipbuilding, where he has spent his career. This conversation is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. Mike, welcome aboard. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Vago, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
It's always an honor and pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Mike, congratulations on 10 years of freedom as an independent firm. Shipbuilding remains at your core, but you were way ahead of the power curve in projecting the flattening in defense spending that we're seeing now, and started to work to diversify the company, whether it was in oil services. Technical services has been an area of growth where you guys landed your largest ever non-shipbuilding contract, $1 billion with the U.S. Air Force, which I think got a lot of attention. You've been engineering an unmanned future for the company. The Hydroid deal is the biggest in that portfolio. And you've even set up an unmanned center of excellence. You're selling off the oil business, obviously, because that's been, prices have been low and the pandemic was tough. What's your strategic planning process? How is that process going to shape the company in another 10 years as the Navy talks about more distributed shipbuilding, expresses some, I think, maybe reticence about the future of the carrier, with great work if you can get it, but you have one customer for it? What's the process, and where are you going to be in a decade?
Wow, that's a big question, Vago. That's something that we wrestle with every day in terms of where we might go. The process itself starts with a couple of basic tenets. First of all, we are charged as leaders in this company by all of our stakeholders, our customers, our employees, our shareholders, the communities where we are, as the largest employer in two states. That's a unique responsibility. And even our suppliers, we're charged with leading the company to achieve the full potential of this capability. And I know that's a bit esoteric, and it seems kind of philosophical, but it actually is something that I think everybody can kind of rally around, because, when was the last time you looked in the mirror at night and said, I achieved my full potential today? And frankly, if you're like me, I don't know that I've ever had very many days where I could, say I did everything. Everything went exactly the way I wanted to today. And most things went better than I expected, and could not have had a better day. There's always something that is out there. And so as a leadership team, our job is to try to wring as much potential out of this business for all of those stakeholders as we possibly can. Now, the way we do that is that we've learned, as you mentioned 10 years ago, when we left Northrop, we were truly single focused on ships, most of them for the U.S. Navy. We did have and still do have a product line for the Coast Guard. But shipbuilding is an incredibly intimate experience with your customer and your employees and your suppliers. It is something that is up close and personal, and you get to understand what your customer understands you, your employees understand you, and you understand them. And if you don't, you're not going to do very well in that business. Well, we've extrapolated that to how can we bring that intimacy we have with the Navy and the Coast Guard. How do we bring that sort of thinking to other customers who have big challenges, and we might actually have solutions for them. And when you're intimate like that, what happens is you start to figure out what are the biggest problems that are out there that need to be solved, and how can we help create a solution for those problems? And then that becomes sort of the driver for us in terms of strategic thinking, is we're interested in finding customers who have really big problems that we can create some kind of channel of access to give them access to solutions that we might have. And if we really are intimate with those customers, we begin to understand not just what their biggest problem today is, but maybe what their biggest problems in the future might be. And we can begin to develop some solutions to those problems and broaden the access to those solutions. So that's kind of the way we think about it. It feels kind of qualitative because it's very qualitative. And I think good strategy in general tends to be very, very qualitative, and as opposed to quantitative. And so that's kind of the way we go about it. We've had some success. We've had some stuff that didn't go as well as we thought. But, you know, we're planting seeds and we're trying to see which ones sprout. And so far, I think we're net positive on that.
You've talked about this before that, you know, and I think a lot of people don't understand that shipbuilding is everything from brute force and heavy plate steel to Swiss watch precision with which you have to do everything, right? You guys are, mm-hmm. are great at software, at electrics, nuclear, right? All of the elements that go into complex warships, whether they're, you know, a high-end Coast Guard cutter or a nuclear carrier or a ballistic missile sub or an amphibious ship or an attack submarine. What are examples in your mind of good strategy that you seek to emulate and bad strategy you seek to avoid?
You know, one person's strategy is another person's tactics. And so I think at the first level, I think that you cannot be thinking broad enough in the way you're doing strategy. How wide open is your aperture in terms of the options, the challenges, the opportunities? Are you really thinking, when, you know, people say, are you thinking strategically enough? What I think that means is, are you thinking wide enough? And I think that one of the things that we look at when we look at a problem is, and we ask ourselves, it's really the first question that we ask before we put a lot of calories into trying to get there is, are we really the best group to be trying to solve that problem? Explain to me why we're better at solving that problem than the people that are working on it. What do we have to offer that nobody else does? Or how can we create a solution that no one else or other folks or our solution, how could that be better? But that very first question is, why are we the better solver of that problem? I think is fundamental to good strategy. Let's just pick it what you want, R&D or M&A, any of those categories of things you can, or capital investment, even the things you can put your money into, because how you deploy your cash is really, that's the result of good strategy. You can go and buy up everybody that's on the market, but if you're not really a better owner of the companies that are on the market, you're not going to get the value out of them that you need. You can go and invest. I mean, quite frankly, a company like us cannot afford to keep up with some of the other companies in terms of the amount of R&D that we can do. So to try to outspend somebody else in research and development to create a better gadget faster than someone else, I mean, that might make sense for somebody who's got kind of unlimited resources, but it doesn't make sense for us. And at the end, I think that when you go into strategy, and I've heard a lot of people try to do this, they go into a strategic discussion and they say, let's start with a clean whiteboard or a clean piece of paper and talk about strategy. I don't think it's a good strategy until you put constraints on it and you actually tell yourself, no, we can't afford to do that. We don't have the talent to do that. That's not our lane. when you start telling yourself no about the stuff that's on that piece of paper, that's when it turns into a good strategy. Before that, it's just an academic paper.
You effectively have to know yourself, right? Better than anybody, and be brutally candid about what you are and what you can do and what you can't do.
I think the brutal, your words, to be brutally candid, I think that's the key. I think most of the folks that are in our business know themselves really well, and they know their customers really well. But you can convince yourself that this is the way things are going to break. And if you're not really candid with yourself, you can end up making some pretty big mistakes.
There are not many that I've known. I mean, I'm sure if you go back, not to dredge up Constantin Veliotis's name, right? But shipbuilders have a tendency of being grounded. Do you think that it's the unique nature of the business, right? It's complexity, it's long cycle nature, it's extraordinarily high capital requirements to remain competitive at the front edge and the technology required. Is that something you think that puts shipbuilders apart, that these are really national trusts? Yours certainly is, right? At a certain level, I'm sure Electric Boat would say the same thing. Bath would say the same thing. I'm sure Pascagoula as NASSCO, right? I mean, the big yards would say that. Do you think that there's something different in the nature of the work that makes those involved in it somewhat more strategic?
I don't know that I can compare because I truly haven't spent a lot of time outside of the, it's not like I ever ran a production line for a jet airplane or anything like that. So I'm not really sure that I can do a comparison there. I can tell you what I love about shipbuilding though, is that in our shipyards, and you mentioned other great shipyards. And I think, if you look, we're the largest employer in two states. Those other shipyards are also the largest employers in their states, and so you're talking about a place, and let me just talk about our yards. You're talking about a place where all of the industrial and technological, all the industrial capacity and technological know-how of our nation intersects in our shipyards. We bring in parts and components from across the country. In our case, it's about 5,000 suppliers, and I'm not sure we've got all 50 states today, but we typically rotate through all 50 states. They're all showing up in our shipyard. We are assembling those with technical expertise that is state of the art and cutting edge. We are bringing that together in concert with our customer, the Navy, where we're going to take a crew of predominantly 18 to 22 year old sailors. And we're going to form the crew and bring all of this metal and all of this cable and energy. And we're going to pull all of that together and we're going to mold that into something that nobody else in the world can do. That's pretty powerful. And yes, it takes time. When we have contracts today that run out, not just the, I've always said that we're building ships for the administration after next. We're actually building ships that are for the administration after that. And so you have to actually be able to step above it all and see a distant horizon to make sure that you can kind of have a direction to go. I mean, the old line from, what is it, Peter Pan, second star to the right or something like that. I mean, that's kind of the way we have to think about it. Straight on till morn. I mean, that's our direction. Is we find a distant horizon, we aim in that direction. We have to bring all of those national assets together to that intersection to produce something that no one else can do. And I had an admiral one time tell me, and it stuck with me, it's that, he said, there never has a U.S. sailor on a U.S. ship sailed into a foreign port and wished that they were on the ships that were already tied up there. They would never trade a U.S. ship for any of the ships that anybody else is producing. I think that's true, and I'm proud that we're part of that.
You've had a varied career within the bandwidth of Navy and shipbuilding, right? You attended the Naval Academy. You were a submariner. Mm-hmm. You joined Newport News. out of the Navy, working on the Los Angeles class attack submarine program. You held engineering contract pricing jobs as well as human resources. What did that journey teach you about becoming a good CEO?
Well, first of all, I think they're still trying to find a job that I can do. They keep moving me from one job to another.
You've had the last one for 10 years, right? That's pretty good.
Well, but I think I'm now in the place where nobody else wants this job. So, by default. No, I never set out to say that, I'm going to come to work in this company and someday I'll hope to be the CEO, right? My ambition all along was to have a vocation that I'd be excited to get up to go to work to every day, and that would be making a difference, and that I could personally grow, and that I wouldn't become very stagnant, and that's been true in our business, and that's been certainly true for me. And the advantage of seeing lots of different parts of the business from lots of different angles just gives you, that just gives you a perspective that has really helped me. I mean, it's unusual, I think, but the tradition at Newport News Shipbuilding for a long time was that prospective presidents or CEOs of the company would go through human resources, because that's really a great training ground for CEOs. A lot of companies don't get that, because HR is a very technical place. But in our business, because we are so dependent on the people that choose to come to work every day and give us the best part of themselves, being in that job is a great way to kind of put your head around that in a way that, you're going to have to run programs, you're going to have to run P&Ls, you're going to have to learn how to talk to customers, and everybody has to go through that. But the uniqueness of actually sitting in the HR position and dealing with that strategic asset of the company, that's something that I would say was very, very important in my development.
And what are the sort of most important lessons over the years, right? I mean, whether from the oil services, whether from Ford, whether even the loss of FFGX, what are some of the lessons along the way that stand more starkly for you?
Well, I think you can, at the highest level, I think that, because each of the things that we've talked about have their own unique kind of lessons. When you have something where you trip over your shoelaces, it's frustrating to go back and see that often the reason you tripped over your shoelaces was because you're making a mistake again. Very seldom in our business do we make new mistakes. Most of the mistakes we end up making are mistakes we've made before. And that's that's always a bit of a challenge for us. If our charge is to achieve our full potential, then we got to wring out all those second time mistakes as best we can. But I think in general, I think that at the through all of this, I think it's been, because there's stuff that's gone really well as in addition to some of the stuff that's been more challenging. It's to have a real deep sense of purpose of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And, if you're doing that, then you're going to have days where things don't always work out. But, the thing that I tell the team often is that, our job is to score as many runs. I love baseball, Vago. We've talked about this. And so our job as a team is to score as many runs as possible. Well, you show me a team where every runner they send home is safe, and I will show you a team that's not scoring as many runs as they can. So you got to get some guys thrown out at home just to know that you're getting the full amount of runs out of the game as possible. And the other thing is, you can't get to home without touching third base. There are no shortcuts in this. You've got to go and you've got to touch every base on the way there. If you skip one, you may get past it for a period of time, but eventually the umpire is going to figure out that you missed third base or you missed second, and that run's not going to count. And in our business, when that happens, that's bigger than just losing a run. I mean, that's your credibility and everything else is at stake. And so leading with integrity, learning from those runners that get thrown out at home, those are things that have to be central to how you build the company.
You mentioned Right. I mean, there are lessons that you learn. You can try to advise your customer. You do have a headstrong customer that has ideas of its own.
Your words, not mine.
Those are my words, not yours, in fairness. Right. But I mean, Ford, for example, I mean, I remember talking to people in the company at the point, and it was like, look, this is a lot of stuff to do in one ship. And we do stuff like this. And I know that there was a very robust debate, and I don't want to retread that. But more broadly, the Navy is now considering a strategic shift from a fewer number of larger and more expensive platforms to a much more distributed force of smaller ships that don't necessarily have to be built in giant shipyards like the ones you run. And that was the intention of LCS, right? Let's bring new blood into this. But if you don't have a strategic industrial plan for four shipyards, it becomes more complicated with six, right? Be careful what you wish for. And now there's this sense, hey, we can get fleet numbers up by having a lot more shipbuilders involved in this. What does that potential shift by your customer away from, right, big deck amphibious ships, which is a marquee product of yours, questions about what the future of the aircraft carrier looks like, and hey, maybe we need fewer of them. What does all of that mean for your strategy?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that it's been our view for a while that the future for the Navy is probably many, many faster, smaller, and cheaper, as opposed to few bigger, slower, and expensive, right? And so if you just kind of think about that, and that is how do you bring industrial capacity to shift from, and I'm not just talking about us, I'm talking about a national industrial capacity for shipbuilding that's been building, what I would say contextually fewer ships that are bigger, more complex, and resultingly more expensive. How do you bring that to something that's many faster, smaller, and cheaper? How do you do that? Well, it's not hard to understand that if you could take a marketplace where there's a lot of competitors, you can create an awful lot of innovation. You take the most fragmented markets and you see tremendous amounts of innovation and energy in those spaces. But you better have some strategic direction if you're the customer of that market, because you need to know where you're going to go. From my standpoint, I have never seen this as either or. I don't think, quite honestly, the last administration was kind of coming through their work, Vago, they didn't go down the path that you just went in your question. I mean, they basically said, we're going to augment the carrier fleet with, we want to go study lighter carriers to augment the carrier fleet that we have. We want to look at how do we use smaller ships to augment the larger ships that we have. It easily decays into kind of a soundbite of it's either or, but I don't see it as either or. I see it as, yes and kind of solution. And I guess the advice that I have given to Navy leadership over the last year to two years or so has been, it's one thing to pick up a chart and say, we're going to change the pick your ship class, destroyer. We're going to take that destroyer out and we're going to put two smaller kinds of platforms in there instead of that. Well, we see these, we call in the industry, at least in our part of the industry, we call those slash charts, and those slash charts change every year. I mean, they basically take the SCN account for the next 5 years and they compare it to last year's, and you see lines through them from here's what's changed from last year. And all of that's interesting, but what I would offer is that there's another part of that is we need to strategically think of the industry itself as a platform, as an asset in that discussion. If you have 5,000 suppliers lined up to support 35,000 shipbuilders in my company, and then add in the other shipyards that are out there, and their set of suppliers. And you have an industrial footprint, industrial capacity that's certainly agile enough to respond to direction, but it's not a light switch. And you can't just go and, you know, do a hard left turn on somebody without causing tremendous amounts of disruption in the current industrial base, especially if you're trying to turn to an industrial base that may not even be there yet. So the discussion has to be, you know, it's a national effort, as I said at the beginning. How do we drive the national effort to move in the direction that we think we need to be in operationally or strategically? And honestly, that gets back to how well we know our customers, how well they know us, how well we understand what their future problems might be, and how well we can develop solutions for what those future problems are. That's about dialogue. That's about, you know, a lot of interaction and a lot of discussion. And I feel pretty good about that kind of dialogue that's been going on. I don't really sense that somebody's going to go behind a curtain and pop a big surprise out there and say, okay, we just changed our mind and erase everything we did before today, and here's a whole new plan. Because I think both the industry and the Pentagon both know that that's a recipe for disaster. Now, our view of it is, if we see something that we think that needs to be done, like we've been investing in unmanned now for 5 years, 5 or 6 years. We believe that the future of the Navy is going to be, there's going to be a lot of unmanned capability in the Navy. And we have put a lot of our coin up against that to try to turn that into a self-fulfilling prophecy for the Navy. To think that the unmanned business is going to replace the industry, you know, for the destroyers or something, I think that's not the way to think about that. But I think if you think about the unmanned business as a way to augment the capacity and capability of a platform, then that's a pretty powerful image. So that's kind of the way we're thinking about it, and that's how we're thinking about the problems that need to be solved.
I want to come back to your unmanned in a second. Obviously, the Navy has released its unmanned framework. For some, it's not very satisfying. But I want to just ask you a sort of a shipbuilding and maritime industrial base question. The Navy sort of tries to do this in its 30-year shipbuilding plan, but it doesn't look like the industrial dynamics of it are fully understood, is, I guess, my point, right? You're absolutely right, Mike. This shouldn't be an either or. There's going to be a role for the big platforms. There's going to be a role for the smaller. And as Elaine Luria recently said to me, right, an even smaller surface combatant that might be necessary. But at the end of the day, these do end up becoming either or decisions, in part because the budget is finite, right? Critics look at the littoral combat ship and say, look, that's consuming an enormous amount of resources that then puts the Navy into a position to say, okay, I'm going to skip an RCOH, right? I mean, everything, as you said, each dollar with it is precious, and where you put that ends up mattering. Do we need some sort of national industrial maritime naval and shipbuilding strategy given, right, if you go to talk to Mark Busby or would talk to Mark Busby, he would tell you, we don't have enough surface, you know, we don't have a merchant force large enough to support our war fighting and wartime needs, right? I mean, those ships would get attrited. We'd lose 2/3 or, you know, what 3/4 of them in the first week, right? That's sobering. What's the kind of strategy we need?
Yeah, so you mentioned a 30-year plan. I think the 30-year plan is a leading document, in that it's a way to communicate. It's a pretty effective way to communicate to all the stakeholders, the industry, the members of Congress, the citizens, the taxpayers, however you want to frame it. It's a way for the Navy to go out and say, this is the direction that we need to go. Our view of that is that, frankly, we get a little bit like the old Kremlinologists, right? I mean, you would, you remember those days, Spago, where you'd see a picture of the folks leading the Politburo, right? And then the next picture you would see, people would be standing in different places, and we'd all try to figure out, okay, what does that mean that he's standing to the left and now to the right. Well, you know, we do a little bit of that with a 30-year plan. You know, when they come out, the first thing somebody in the company will do, so in the industry, frankly, will do is compare it to the last one. And, you know, some folks will get fixated on, you know, in the last 30-year plan, there were 17 of these ships. And in this 30-year plan, there's 21 of those ships. So what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean four more ships. What it means is there's more emphasis. And so now you got to peel that back and say, what does that mean for, why is there more emphasis? You know, and how do we get, how do we understand that shift in emphasis that's come up? That shows itself in the leading document of the 30-year plan, because the 30-year plan by itself is just it's just a report. It's not even a budget document, you know, in that sense. And then we'll trace the threads back. We'll trace back from the 30-year plan to the budget document, you know, the budgets that get submitted, the budgets that get approved. We'll look at, you know, what sort of long lead time material is being bought. I mean, it's one thing to say you want to buy more of this kind of ship, but if it requires long lead procurement and you're not doing long lead procurement, I'm not sure the industry is going to believe you're doing that. And that's why I think that we've got to find a way to create even more conversation with all the stakeholders in a way that's very frank. You know, I think in, you know, the future is going to require the country to get another, take another turn on, you know, risk. How do we understand risk? And how do we talk about risk? And how do we prepare annual budgets around items that have long-term value but near-term risk? How do we do that? And I think those are all very important decisions. And I don't think it gets parochial. I mean, you could sit down and say we need more submarines or we need more smaller ships and all that stuff. Well, that's all true in the sense that whoever's saying that has a reason to say that, and with a lot of integrity and a lot of thought into it. But the bigger discussion is, how are we going to have a discussion about where we need to go, what that looks like, and how do we get there, and how can we stomach getting there? Because some of the things we're going to need to do are going to require us to have a conversation about risk.
Well, I mean, and you're putting your finger right on that, right? I mean, we have a tendency of trying to optimize for peacetime. So we don't have enough yard capacity to repair the broken ships, right? I mean, there are policy and a bunch of other elements that play into this. But I think if you just ask just about everybody, we don't have enough dry dock capacity. Whenever you talk about a great power confrontation at sea, there are going to be a lot of broken and damaged ships, especially if your adversary's tactic will be to wound and damage ships, right? I mean, purposefully to give you, so you know, you've got, it ties up escorts. You're going to have to tow it. You're going to have to do a whole bunch of things. It strains your resources, right? I mean, is that part of the discussion we need to have? Do we have the infrastructure and industrial footprint? Because we had three damaged ships that hamstrung a lot of national industrial capability, and there were cruisers and destroyers.
Yeah, I have two reactions to this. First is, I think the pandemic has shown us some of the fallacies that we have in terms of optimization and how that increases our risk and not reduces it. And I want you to think for a minute about hospitals, Vago. You know, at the very beginning of the pandemic, the number one concern, and it's still our number one concern now, is about the hospital's capacity to handle the virus, right? And so what happened? Why were we worried about the hospital's capacity? Because for years, we have managed the healthcare system in an attempt to optimize it. And I don't know about anywhere else, but I know that if you want to add a bed to a hospital in Newport News, Virginia, for the hospital in Newport News, Virginia to add that bed, they actually have to go to Richmond and get approval, because Richmond is how the money flows in terms of the insurance and everything else. And if another hospital says, you know, I don't want you to add that bed, I want to add that bed, then the bed doesn't get added. And suddenly we don't have any surge capacity in our ICUs or our hospitals for those moments for peak. They're basically We've built our healthcare system, and it became exposed this year. We built our healthcare system, you know, to manage the day to day, and we would, you know, we didn't have a real thought about it. Didn't seem to me, anyway, as a casual observer sitting way up high in the bleachers, it didn't seem to me that we had really thought our way through peak use and surge and all that sort of thing that could happen to us, even though a lot of smart people in the country were thinking about pandemic 20 years ago. And I think that's a direct result of, you know, you're putting people in positions where they are, their idea of risk, it's risky for them to run over budget. See, that's the risk. And I think that when it comes to national security, it's probably true of the hospitals, I'm less conversant on that. When it comes to national security, what I find is that if you overrun a budget, you fail. I've told you this story, I know, but several years ago, I guess probably maybe 15 years ago now, but I was actually up on the Hill attending a conference. And I finished the morning panel and I left the panel. I went over to the Navy Yard. And on my way to the Navy Yard to meet with the admirals over there, I got a report from one of my folks that the five programs with the largest amount of cost growth in the budget submission were identified. And they were, and they went through the five programs. But the fifth one was the Virginia class program. I was shocked. Because at that time, the Virginia class program was the gold standard for how you run a program. Still is, by the way. I went in and I sat down with the admiral and I said, did you know that Virginia class got identified as one of the top five programs with cost growth? And it was flying all over. And everybody was saying, what's wrong with the Virginia class program? He picked up the phone. He made a few phone calls and he came back. He said, now I understand it. He said, this is the year we went from one submarine to two. All we had done is we'd expanded the buy, but it came out in a report that said there was cost growth. And everybody that heard cost growth said, the program must be in trouble and it's failing. And that's not the case at all. We were moving from one to two because it was actually so successful that we were able to increase the production. So I think that we've got to go work on language and risk and how are we going to accommodate that? We've got to have that kind of conversation. This annual budget cycle is a real challenge because, you know, my company, we don't think in annual budget cycles. I mean, we do annual plans and all that sort of thing, but we're signing contracts that are going to go into the next decade. So, you know, we think about risk and investment in a much different way than you do if you're just trying to manage an annual budget where a budget overrun is a failure.
You know, to that point, though, and I do have a couple of programmatic questions, and I haven't forgotten that we have to talk about unmanned as well, and I want to talk about speed. But does, you know, the administration, Mike, is working on a $3 trillion infrastructure plan. And Elaine Luria and a number of other people have said that there should be a lot of military investment that should go into this, that shipyards, whether they're on the government side or on the private side, are a national strategic capability for the nation in a way that's not the same in other industrial sectors, right? Those industrial sectors can flex a lot more. How much of that investment, right? I mean, does there need to be to your risk discussion and the candid nature of the discussion, do we need to put a bunch of extra dry docks and graving docks in this? Does there need to be that kind of capitalization and recapitalization at shipyards, right? I mean, your main dock dates from World War I. It's not that it's not a capable dock, right? But there are tide issues, climate is driving it, right? I mean, so there has to be investment. Do we need a more national strategic approach to how we're going to make this investment? Because if you don't have the capacity, you can't move fast, especially if somebody's shooting at you.
Yeah, so it would be easy to say, sure. I think there's two parts to the question, though. And I think the first one would be, everybody wants to talk about what do we do when we are shooting at each other. And you know, that's interesting. That's interesting to think about what happens if we're actually shooting each other. But honestly, if we're shooting at each other, we've probably failed. Because both of us, and I'm going to say both of us, you pick your geopolitical competitor. Both of us have tremendous destructive capability to inflict serious harm on somebody else's society. And so if we get to the point where we're shooting each other, then all the other stuff that we need to do before that that's designed to keep that from happening has failed. So I think that a lot of thought, it seems to me the preponderance of thought goes down to the old order of battle stuff, you know, that the British had these many ships of the line and the French had these many ships of the line. And so that gave the British an inherent advantage and, you know, all that order of battle stuff. Well, that all presumed conflict. But the real value is in making sure that the conflict never happens. That's the opportunity for us, is to make sure it doesn't happen. Well, okay, how's the best way to do that? Some of it, you got to show some muscle. You got to show that you have to show you're willing to deter, that you're going to show up on the day that you need to be there, and you're going to walk the beat. That's been the Navy strategy for all of my lifetime, for sure, is to be be on the beat, forward deployed, expeditionary, with the national will to engage. That goes a long way to making sure that we, in the end, don't start shooting at each other. So now if you kind of think about it that way, then you step back and say, okay, how do I invest against that? Well, investing against that is going to be, it's going to be R&D. It's going to be capital investments. It's going to be, facilities for sure. It's also going to be workforce. And I would argue that, and you and I have talked about this offline too, I would argue that every opportunity we have to improve the educational system in this country is going to allow us to be more competitive in that geopolitical strategic competition. This idea that only 25% of our high school graduates are even eligible to be recruited to the armed services today, that's absurd. We can't compete. I mean, we may have won the Cold War with a circumstance like that. The future competition is going to require us to be better at that, because we're going to need more of those folks, and we're going to need more of their brain capacity and brain power to be applied. And remember, my business is, at least on the shipbuilding side, is the intersection of all of that technology talent, the engineering talent, the craftsman talent. It all intersects in our facilities. Let's go make sure that we invest in the people that we are going to need to go do that. I think that's a much larger thought than let's just go build more dry docks. You know, there's certainly, you could then go into the war planning scenarios and the conflict scenarios and say, you know what, we've only got these many dry docks in theater. We're going to need twice that many or something like that. And, you know, there are people that can go figure all that out, and they would be right to do that. And that should be a portion of the investment. But I think the big strategic investments are going to be in people.
So let me ask you about that. You guys have a very unique program. I think most of our listeners know this, right? Where it's more selective than Harvard, and that's no joke. For your apprentice program, to get people, give them those skills so that they become those master shipwrights, for lack of a better word, a decade downstream, right? Given the strict quality just the strict quality standards you guys have in the United States Navy has. But you guys also have been investing in game-changing automation that's at the cutting edge. What does that capability, that technology mean to build ships faster with higher quality? And what does that in turn do to the manpower, right? The human component that you do need, because you've always told me, right, this is never going to be an automated business. And even automation has limits to what it is that is going to be the art element of this, right? But how does that dynamic change, and how soon will it be before you roll out some of the capabilities you've been developing over the past couple of years?
Yeah, well, first of all, Vago, once again, I'm going to I'm going to suggest that maybe things are not as binary as we would like to present them. The fact of the matter is we're doing more work today inside the shipyards with maybe half to two thirds as many people. We're doing more work today than we did in the height of the Reagan buildup.
Right.
You know, I mean, and so, I mean, you could go, you can, I got hired into Newport News in 1987. There were 31,000 people in Newport News. And the order book was pretty full. The order book at Newport News today is significantly fuller than it was then. And Newport News is less than 25,000 people, you know, and it would be, you know, you and I can just both agree that the stuff we're building today is substantially more complex than what we were doing back then. Right. And so we've been applying to, this isn't something where we're waking up now and just going to say, let's go apply technology. We've been applying technology and automation throughout my whole career. And as you know, what we've seen is that it does reduce some of the folks that we're doing, you know, we don't have guys in the sail loft anymore, right? But now we have to have folks who know how to do welding by computer, you know, and they have to be able to use some of the ergonomic tools that we give them to be able to take new tools and new processes into the ship. What we are seeing is that this technology is going to improve time to talent pretty substantially. We've taken, in some of the pilots that we've done, we've taken similar spaces, and we've had well-experienced crews that are on this 10th or 12th time they've built the space with lots of experience under their hands, and we've compared them to an inexperienced crew with digital tools that augmented reality to help them build the space. And we have been very impressed with the results. I mean, we get similar results from those things, and often more efficient. So that's what the first place we're going to see the technology impact us is in time to talent with our people. And then we're going to see, you know, I think we are going to see, you know, more opportunities to bring automation into places we hadn't thought about it before. It changes the way you think about how do we build the ship and how do we plan to build the ship and where do we, you know, how do we turn it more into the Lego block kind of system that everybody imagines? I mean, as an old physics guy, I would say the boundary conditions are really important, right? You establish boundary conditions and then see what does it take to get there. You know, a boundary condition for the Navy and shipbuilding and the industry is unmanned ships built by unmanned shipyards. I mean, that may perfectly be that boundary at infinity that we always joked about.
Right.
But if you're thinking about that, you know, how do you do that? How do you actually build a ship without ever touching it? Well, that doesn't mean you're not going to have people doing it. They're just going to be doing it differently. And so in my sense of it is it's going to be the technology is all about the people, but it ain't a new problem for us. We've been working our way through this for, you know, over 30 years of my career. I've been watching this happen.
You elegantly brought us to the unmanned question at this point. You guys have been working on a vision for a number of years. You've now got an unmanned center of excellence. How do you see this, right? I mean, Mike, you mentioned the fact that you expect many more smaller platforms in larger numbers to be working with, right, the larger platforms at the end of the day. The Navy has rolled out its unmanned strategy. What do you think is needed to effectively blend existing ships with this new unmanned capability? And how have you guys thought through how you fully support those unmanned platform needs, right? You know, how to refuel them, how to self-defend them, make them reliable at the end of the day. I mean, are those along the lines you guys are thinking, or have you helped figure that out and have you fed it over to the Navy at this point, given how many people have serious concerns about whether the Navy has really thought this through as well as it should have thought it through? Again, my words, not yours.
Yeah, I would say we're probably not much further down the road than our customers are in terms of thinking about the the utilization of the platforms. I mean, you know, our entry into this pool was kind of in the shallow end of the pool of let's just go figure out how these things work and then how can they be manufactured, and where the center of excellence is about how can they be manufactured much more efficiently. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the genesis of where we are as we're evolving here. The straight answer to the question is, how do you figure all this out? You got to get in the deep end of the pool. You got to go try stuff, you know, and now we're back to the discussion around risk. You know, you got to be able to go and try stuff and be willing to try stuff that might fail or is even likely to fail, and glean all of the lessons you can learn from that. You know, I have a brother that works at NASA, and he and I have talked about this a little bit. If you go back, and I'm old enough now to remember this, you know, I grew up in Florida, and we would watch the space shots on television, and we'd walk out in the backyard, and about a minute into the flight, we'd see the rockets come up over the orange trees, right? We were on the West Coast, they were coming from the East Coast. That's pretty cool. I can't remember the Mercury flights, I must confess, but I remember the Gemini flights. And you go back now and look at the history of that program. And what you'll see is they had flights scheduled every 60 days. And just about every single one of those missions had a major problem. In-flight mission had a major problem that they worked their way around. They, you know, a little bit of baling wire and bubble gum, and they got their way through the mission until they got to the last one, to number 12. Number 12 seemed to go off without a hitch. And they came back from number 12 and they said, okay, we're going to the moon. Now, when you go back and look at the history of that program and you think about what happened on, you know, pick your number, number 3 or number 4. If that happened to us today, what would happen? My goodness. Unless we had come to have some great understanding, like we got to get to the moon by the end of the decade that they had, we would get into a whole lot of okay, who knew what when, how did this fail? How do we make sure that no one can ever make this mistake again? And so I think that rallying point around the risk is where do we need to be? When do we need to be there? And how much risk can we take in getting there? And I think that's where we are with the unmanned. We're at the very front end of this. You know, there's sort of a wide open field of possibilities and potentials that have to be tested and explored. We're going to find some things that we think are going to work really well are not going to work at all. And we're going to find some things that we never anticipated are going to turn out to be incredibly important to us. But we're not going to know that until we get into the deep end of the pool with platforms married up with, you know, large platforms married up with small platforms, trying to control platforms at distance, trying to control vehicles at distance. I mean, you know, how do we do all that? Well, you don't do it on paper. You do it in the pool. That's how you learn to swim. So that's my view, is we got to be very experimental about this, and we got to be eyes wide open on the discussion around risk. I think we'll get it right.
You know, I mean, you struck on the risk element of this, right? As well as the speed part of this. And I want to get to this. We have the processes we have because that's what they've developed, right? Everybody is risk averse. Nobody wants to spend any extra money. But at the end of the day, you served aboard one of the great 41 for Freedom boats. And I think that people don't appreciate, right? Nautilus was in 1955. First SSBN patrol was in 1960. 5 years later, we developed the sub, the CONOPS, you name it, the warhead, the weapon. I mean, it was just an incredible capability that we fielded. And then we developed 41 ballistic missile submarines. At the time, we were building something like 40 Sturgeon-class attack submarines. I mean, we were splashing, what, 8 submarines a year? Or at least 6 submarines a year, if memory serves correctly. Nautilus's first refueling wasn't done in 18 months, was done in 2 months. Right. And that was with a prototype reactor on the ship. What are the things, Mike, that, you know, at a time when the Indo-Pacific commander is saying we've got 6 years, a 6-year window, if we want to deter Russia, right? I mean, to the heart of your point, to deter China from acting on Taiwan, for example, or one of its other territorial claims, thereby triggering what it is exactly that nobody wants to happen. What do we need to change? How do we do this to get to that accelerated speed and to develop and to field things? I mean, you guys designed the Essex-class aircraft carrier in 2 years, and by the time World War II was over, you guys helped oversee what, three other yards that built them, and 24 of the ships were finished in 5 years. I mean, that's extraordinary. You're right. Can we even do that? And if we can do that, what has to happen to get us to do that on the government side and on the industry side?
Well, first of all, I'm a big optimist, so I believe things like that can happen. But I think you have to recognize that it's not going to happen with if we keep doing things the way that we do them today. And I guess I'll just, and I don't know that I have an answer to this. This is just one of those peanut gallery comments and observations. I think we've gotten ourselves into a place where in all walks of society, not just in shipbuilding, but I think across the country and across all of our society, we've gotten ourselves into a place where if somebody makes a mistake, we're going to create a set of rules to make sure that no one can ever make that mistake again. And those kinds of things tend, instead of going back to that person and saying, you know, you screwed this up. We trained you not to do this and you screwed it up. That's not to say that rules are bad, but my goodness, we've got arthritis when it comes to, a mistake. And if you think in an environment where we're going to have to do a lot of experimentation, we're going to have to have a lot of trial and error, a lot of runners thrown out at home. If you think that you can go into that environment and still live with this idea that, a budget problem is a career threatening mistake for somebody, you can't get there. We got to figure that out. And Vagva, I would tell you that most Americans actually know this and deal with this. We see it on those programs that are on TV all the time, the home builder programs. Right. Everything goes along just fine for about 20 minutes, two-thirds of the way through the program. Everything's fine. The scope is good. The project is going along great. Right. And then there's a problem. And when the problem comes up, there's tension. The dramatic tension is, what do I do? Do I change the scope or do I adjust the budget or how do I deal with all this? And then they find a resolution and get through that. Most Americans understand that. They understand that. We've got to figure out how to understand that inside the Beltway.
Let me ask you one last question, which is about how the threat environment is changing, given the kind of capabilities our adversaries are fielding. Chinese are looking at hypersonic, area denial, precision strike, and are beginning, based on our research, getting good at it. Like the weapons are actually hitting targets and damaging them badly. In that kind of an environment, Mike, is it time for us to sort of reconsider the fundamental survivability, right? I mean, if you end up at the bottom of the ocean, whether you cost $14 billion or $100 million, right? The thing is, you're still at the bottom of the ocean. Is it time for us to take maybe a different mindset, one that focuses on greater sustainability, one on greater flexibility, more standardization, trade-offs in survivability? Are we at that point where we can leverage? I mean, you guys have extraordinary amounts of data that you can harness in this. Do we need to take sort of change our mindset about what we need and maybe deliver differently? I'm not saying that the Ford class aircraft carrier isn't a great ship, right? But maybe in light of all of these things, do you need to make an adjustment? Like, are we at that point where we need to make that mental adjustment?
I don't know. I'm not sure I'm the deepest geopolitical thinker. What I do think that we've got to pay attention to is we've got to learn how to be more asymmetric. I think that's really the issue is we got to find ways to get more security per dollar or readiness per dollar, or readiness per whatever you, however you want to characterize the investment. You could per person if you want to do it that way. But I think that finding ways to change the game so that you know, we're on the, we're not on the wrong side of the asymmetric, and I think it's all asymmetric equations. And I think trying to find ways to do that. That's why we've been so committed to unmanned. We think that subsurface is an incredibly asymmetric place to be. And we think that that's going to be a great opportunity for us. And so that's where we put a lot of investment in that. That's not to say that, you know, the we'll go back to what I said before, if you're slinging missiles at each other, it's already too late. Right. And the challenge that you have is that if you're going to be forward deployed and you're going to be on the beat and the Chinese carrier shows up off the coast of Vietnam, if Vietnam is an ally, they're going to want to see the U.S. carrier. And I think that that's just as important in the, let's not ever get to the point where we're throwing missiles at each other. As it is to say we're going to be flying, you know, 60 aircraft off the flight deck, and it's going to have a couple of high powered reactors where we could do all kinds of funny things with energy, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I'm not sure that I would say we're at the point where that presumes that there is a point where we're going to change direction. And I'm not sure that as long as the world is shaped the way it is and our interests are 25 days away. In terms of transit times, I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that we'll make a fundamental change in that. So
I have to ask you one last 30-second question, because I know that people are going to say, hang on a second, you did an interview with Mike Petters and you didn't ask about Ford or RCOH. So the 30-second version of whatever 30-second answer you can give me, a couple of Navy secretaries have raised the need for a smaller carrier. You've always said you'll build whatever it is that they want. Is the Ford class still the right class to build? And the last question is, if you lose an RCOH, how does that affect your strategy?
Well, again, those are questions really better for the Navy than for us. Our job is to make the stuff that we're building, make it as efficient as possible. You know, I've seen these comparisons go on for, you know, basically my whole career. Once you decide that you're going to put nuclear-powered aircraft carrier at sea, the cheapest thing we do is build size. And quite honestly, right now, the Ford is the most capable warship in the world. And the Navy's, you know, I think you could ask the Navy, but I think it was one of the ships last year that was at sea more than most of the others. Where we are in terms of the affordability and efficiency, the first one cost too much. And we put, some of that was us and some of that was bringing all these technologies together. But the second one, we put in a lot of capital to drive the cost out, and we've taken significant man hours out of that. The third and fourth ones were bought in a smart way by buying two of them, and we're taking the cost out of those. I mean, a cost comparison on the Ford class, you're gonna have to actually compare it to what the fifth one would cost, not what the first one did cost. And so that changes the equation. And then it's basically, if you want to do something different than buy the fifth Ford, you should have started thinking about what that is, you know, a few years ago, because the fifth Ford is going to come up in terms of your industrial base ability to support it efficiently and effectively. It's going to come up faster than you think. Relative to the RCOH, I think the issue with the RCOH is whether it gets refueled or inactivated, at least from our standpoint, that's work that we would do. The bigger issue is, if you take a carrier out, what are you going to replace it with? And I think the carrier, I think that was pretty clear in the last discussion that the Congress had with the Navy over this was, tell us what you're going to replace it with. And the answer was, well, we're going to take the savings and go try to figure it out. And, you know, the Congress basically said, we're not comfortable with that. Right. So, you know, I that may change. We may be in a different environment, and that's fine. We'll work our way through that if that's what it comes to. But I think those are kind of two big things. So
they could give you more submarines.
Well, I mean, it's what the nation needs, Vago. It's not what I need.
Right. Right.
I mean, you know, we're here to do what the nation needs. The last thing we need to be is the tail wagging the dog here. If the nation needs more submarines and less carriers, then okay, we'll do that. If the nation needs more carriers to be more affordable, that's what we do. That's what we know how to do. And we're working, you know, round the clock to make that happen.
Can you go 3 attack subs and 1 Columbia a year, or is that a bridge too far?
No, I think the question there is when and for how long. I mean, if you said that I need you to deliver 3 Virginia class submarines next year, I would say we probably can't do that. If you look at the 30-year plan, the Virginia program kind of, you know, it peaks at around somewhere north of 2.5 per year sometime in the next, I think, in the next decade. Yeah, we can certainly do that. And can we support that? Sure. You know, my view is that if you're serious about this, we can build the capacity faster than you can appropriate the money. But you got to show us you're serious. It's got to show up in your planning documents, in your speeches, in your RFPs, in your long lead time material, in your budget submissions. You got to be serious about it. If you're serious about it, we can do it.
Mike, it is always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being so generous with your time. Please thank your team for their extraordinary work. Becky and Jerry have been terrific. Thank you so very much. And already looking forward to the next conversation. Fair winds, well, following seas. Thanks very much, sir.
Thanks, Fago. I enjoy the work that you're doing. I can't say that I hear every show, but I listen to a lot of them. And you do a nice job with your team there. So thanks for having me.